House Labor and Commerce Committee to order, and let the record reflect that the date is February 6th, Monday, 2006. We have members present, Representative Crawford, Guttenberg, Ledoux, Rochberg, myself, Chairman Anderson, and Representative Lynn is here, and Representative Cotta is on his way. We do have a quorum. We have two bills today, House Bill 335, Energy Research and Development, by Representative Berkowitz, and House Bill 393, Insurance for Colorectal Cancer Screening, a very good bill by me. So we'll first go to House Bill 335.
You want a motion to...
Okay, we're going to reverse that order, I'm told. Representatives coming down for HB 335, so we'll just stick with House Bill 393 first.
Now you really do want a motion.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, no, we already had you. Now you alerted the record you weren't here. No. Okay, everyone's present but Representative Cott. Heath Hilliard's here to go over 335, and I will move CS for House Bill 335 for discussion purposes, version I.
39. Mr. Chairman, 393. There's no.
393, pardon me, I'm sorry. We have the original version.
Correct.
And there's no CS, is there?
No.
So strike what I just did. We have House Bill 393, and it's the letter labeled G. That's the version. That was very confusing. Go ahead, Heath.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. for the record, my name is Heath Hilliard, and I'm staff to the chair, Representative Anderson. You have before you today HB 393, an act requiring that certain health care insurance plans provide coverage for colorectal cancer screening. In brief, what this bill does is essentially establish a minimum standard or a requirement that colorectal cancer screening be provided as a standard in healthcare policies provided in this state, particularly for those over the age of 50. Why this is particularly important, though, is that colorectal cancer is a very serious health concern, one that when caught in time or early has a 90% survivability rate. However, if caught late, has about a 10% survival rate. So we believe, as several other states have, that this is an important public health issue that we would like to address, and you have before you HB 393, which does exactly that.
Okay, thank you, Heath. I'd like to have Emily. Emily, are you in Anchorage online?
Now I'm on.
Okay, there we go. We have a few folks that want to testify here in the committee room, off net, and then in Anchorage. But I'd like you to start with your testimony. Obviously, the American Cancer Society endorses this, but if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, and then maybe go into statistics on what other states have adopted this measure and some of the percentages that Mr. Hilliard touched on. And then we can get to more detailed questions from the committee before we go on to more public testimony.
Representative Anderson. For the record, my name is Emily Meenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society. So I cover public policy for the American Cancer Society. I'm very excited to have this bill before you. It's something that I've been researching for about 4 years now, ever since I started working for the American Cancer Society, because screening for colon cancer holds such incredible promise. Colon cancer is, or as it's more technically referred to, colorectal cancer, is the second leading cause of cancer death in the U.S. It's actually third for men, so it goes lung, prostate, colon for men, and lung, breast, colon for women, and then so that makes it second overall. Another thing that you should know, Alaska does have higher than average rates for colon cancer in the general population, and the Alaskan Native population has the single highest rate of colon cancer of any population group in the country, which is just a weird little fact and something that I know the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is working really hard on increasing screening. Here's the thing about screening for colon cancer. If you catch colon cancer in screening, in, say, a colonoscopy, for instance, you can remove polyps before they become cancerous. It's the only screening tool we have that can actually prevent cancer. And also, you can also remove localized cancers at that time. You can actually, through the screening, keep people from ever having to get cancer, which is the main amazing thing. Colonoscopy is over 90% effective at detecting colon cancer. And as Heath mentioned, the survival rates, if you catch colon cancer early, when before symptoms are likely to appear and when it's in a localized stage, there's over a 90% survival rate. You don't catch it until later on, which is when symptoms are likely to start appearing, there's less than 10% survival rate. And we're looking, and when I say survival rate, that's the standard 5-year survival rate. So the promise for screening is incredible. We have been working as the American Cancer Society on this legislation around the country. Currently, 18 states and the District of Columbia have done what this legislation does, which is require the state-regulated plans to cover colon cancer screening according to the American Cancer Society guidelines, which are laid out in the bill. We've also, just so you all know, for those plans that are not state-regulated, we've done a tremendous amount of work with the federal employee health benefit plans. Just in the last couple years, we have increased the number of federal plans covering this tremendously. So we are sort of tackling this from all fronts. This holds tremendous promise. This is the only cancer screening that is not currently covered under state statute. State law requires coverage for breast, cervical, and prostate cancer. Colon cancer is the only cancer with a recommended screening available that's not on that list. So if you wonder why we're picking out colon cancer, it's just because it's the only one that's not on the list. We want to complete that list and give people the opportunity to have all cancer screening covered by insurance. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as we go along here.
Thanks, Emily. Before we get to questions from other members of the committee, I wanted you to target two other areas of explanation on the record so members and folks listening understand. The first is, please address when you talk about colon screening, what aren't there four different types? Just real brief, you don't have to get super descriptive, but so people understand what we're talking about.
Sure. One of the important things about the American Cancer Society guidelines, and this is reflected in the other national guidelines that are out there, federal government guidelines and other the other major guidelines that are out there, is it's important for people to have a choice, for doctors and patients to make the decision about what screening is most appropriate for the patient. Colonoscopy is generally considered to be the gold standard because it's so effective. It can look at the entire colon. It can do, like I said, remove the precancerous polyps. But it's not appropriate for everybody. If you are in frail health, you may not be able to withstand the prep because you have to get cleaned out before you do that. So there are other tests available, and the guidelines that are written out in the bill talk about the fecal occult blood test, which is a simple test looking for blood in the stool, the double contrast barium enema, and the flexible sigmoidoscopy in addition to the colonoscopy. So there are different rates that you'd want to have, like fecal occult blood test once every year, double contrast barium enema. There's different timelines that it's recommended that you double check on that. Colonoscopy only has to be done once every 10 years for the person at average risk. So we're looking at one colonoscopy if you're at average risk starting at age 50, another one at age 60 if you got right in there at 50 and did what you're supposed to do, another one at age 60, and then after 65, Medicare does cover this. So that's another advantage there. We're basically looking at the two colonoscopies that aren't universally covered now.
Okay, Emily, this is Chairman Anderson, so just second question, then we'll get to other comments from the committees or committee members. The second part of the first question is, and just to delineate or reiterate for the record, your point is that when we all cringe here sitting, and some of us have had these procedures, others haven't, none of us are thrilled to have to go through them prospectively or currently, but as funny as it is, the bottom line is that the more intrusive measures, I mean, a stool sample versus getting a tube all the way through your colon, there's a big difference. And so your point is that you can, many folks that will be covered should the bill pass won't have to go through all these. And there is a delineation in age and cost. I mean, because looking through a sample versus having a colonoscopy, isn't there a difference in cost?
Absolutely, there is. But actually, it's interesting. One of the studies that the American Cancer Society commissioned to look at this issue looked at the cost of covering a combination of fecal occult blood tests, the FOBT, and the flexible sigmoidoscopy in combination, which is actually, it's fairly common for insurance companies to cover those, not quite as common for insurance companies to cover colonoscopies. They compared the two. Which is more cost effective? It's actually more cost effective to just start out with the colonoscopy, because you do your FOBT. There's a very high false positive rate with FOBTs. You end up, if you get a positive test result, you end up getting referred on. You may get referred on just to a flex sig first or onto a full colonoscopy. At that point, those are considered diagnostic, not screening tests, because they've already got some kind of a indicator. But you may end up with somebody who goes through the FOBT, gets a false positive, goes on, and has to have a colonoscopy anyway. You've added the tests all on top of each other, because you end up having to get a colonoscopy in the end anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, but that makes sense. Okay, but it is, again, for the record, important to delineate. There are probably four procedures specifically that are used, and there's a difference in costs. And the other quick, if you could give a quick response, has to do with just a hypothetical. So committee members understand. We all shake our heads and say, okay, we understand it's mandatory screening, and we understand who this affects, but do we really? For instance, current state employees are already covered. A hospital like Providence, where in Anchorage, the biggest healthcare system in the state, which is privately insured, isn't covered, nor is this mandating them to be covered. Doesn't this bill primarily target retirees? And who does it cover? So the committee members understand who we're covering.
That's a very good question. Thank you, Representative Chair Anderson. You're right. Active state employees do have this coverage now. And we can all be thankful for that. All of the members of the committee, if they are on the legislator health plan, have this coverage now. And the way the system is set up now, the retired state employee plan does not have this coverage. It varies in other groups of the insurance plans that are state regulated. It varies from plan to plan what's covered. Some may cover a couple of the tests on the list, but not all of them. Some may not cover any. A lot of times, frankly, you get different answers when you call up to ask what's covered, because I've had, you know, people call and get different answers on what's covered. We'd like it to be clear. When you look at the self-insured plans, we are working with some of the larger employers like Providence to make those so that they can make those changes on their own. The state doesn't have the ability to regulate these plans. And like I said, we're working with the federal employee plans as well. So we really feel this piece of getting the state-regulated plans to offer this coverage is a key piece of the puzzle to really combating and bringing down the death rates from colon cancer.
Okay, and I appreciate those responses, Emily. My point in supplementing with that second question with my little editorial is simply to state for the record that should this bill pass, and I'll speak for Emily, who I'm sure concurs, you're not going to see a lineup of people eagerly waiting to get their colonoscopy retirees because the bill's passed. In addition, that's relative to an insurance company, and we will hear from, I think, at least one member from the industry, but I don't think that there's going to be, as a result of my comment, I don't think there's going to be exorbitant costs being raised, because I don't think you'll see a lot more screening being done. We hope there will be, but I don't foresee that. And so I think the point that there's already self-insured and state employees already covered, we're looking at a smaller population than I think committee members realize on who this will affect. Any other questions? Okay, Representative Lynn, then Ledoux, then Roper for Emily.
Just a little clarification, please. I heard that after age 65, everybody who gets Medicare is covered for a colonoscopy. It's scheduled time. Is that correct?
That is.
Now, I see down here, we're talking about people with a high risk of colorectal cancer. That would only be every 1 or 2 years, depending on the top portion, which is everybody. It says once every 10 years for a colonoscopy. But how often is it for somebody at high risk of colorectal cancer?
And Emily, before you answer, Heath Hilliard has a response.
Mr. Chairman, I can point you directly to that section with regard to the high-risk individuals. It clearly states we are on page 2, beginning on line 24, for individuals considered at high risk for colorectal cancers, screening shall be provided at a frequency determined necessary by the health care provider.
So whatever the, if I may, Mr. Chair,
yes.
So whatever your health care provider decides, every year, every 2 years, whatever, that's covered.
That's correct, Representative Lynn.
That
the provisions
okay,
of the
no
bill.
Need to respond to that, Emily. So next,
thank you.
Legislator having a question is Representative Ledoux.
And actually, I've got two questions. The first is on page 1, lines 10 and 11. I just wanted to know why fraternal benefit societies, which have insurance policies, why they're exempted from this.
Thank you for your question through the chair, Representative Ledoux. We wrote it, I think that the sponsor's thinking in writing it that way is to match the other statutes. All the other cancer screening statutes are phrased that way.
Okay, well.
So I don't know if we can answer that. We took that from the other models that are currently in statute.
So why are the other statutes that way?
Through the chair, I think that's a very good question, but I don't know the history on why those were exempted. I also don't know how large a population that would actually be.
And
I would love some information, and maybe if there's somebody there from the Division of Insurance that might know how many plans would fall into that category, that would be good information to know.
And this is Chairman Anderson. Heath will try to supplement that later because I know you're a co-sponsor of the bill, and we'll find out what the history was.
Thank you. I got one other question,
please.
Too. Page 2, paragraph F, where it talks about each health care insurer or health benefit plan notifying each enrollee. Is that the normal standard? I don't remember ever getting from my health care policy, notification that I'm entitled to a certain type of insurance and that I should take the test. Is that just boilerplate?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, my quick answer to that is I think it's a really good idea, and that's one of the reasons it's in there. It has been added more recently in some of the legislation similar to this around the country, so that people actually have an idea of, get some information on what their plans actually cover and what they're eligible for.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Roberg, then we'll move on to the next individual sign up to testify.
Mr. Chairman, could you tell us who you have on your witness list?
We have Stephen Warren from the Sitka Community Hospital in Anchorage. We have Bob Sweeney, Self, Claudia Christensen, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Wanda Katinsky from the State Alaska Cancer Association or Society for answers to questions, if there are any questions, and then Rick Urien, our good friend, who's always here.
So, Mr. Chairman, we have nobody here from the Division of Insurance and no physicians.
Jeffrey Trotton,
the Deputy Director.
That's right.
Okay.
Jeffrey had his name down, too.
That's right.
If Reed, you wanted that on the record, insurance industry, one of the insurance companies' thoughts.
So, do we have any physicians or medical practitioners?
They've all supported it, so no.
If I could interrupt, Chair Anderson, I apologize, but I did want Representative Roberg to know that Brian Sweeney Jr., who is on the phone, is a gastroenterologist here in Anchorage.
Okay.
Okay.
So I can direct my questions to the proper people.
Okay, well then why don't we go next?
Just Mr. Chairman, one point is that just if some information, we do have the insurance here, representative from the Department of Insurance, but just so people understand, some recent information I received from the Division of Insurance is that there is 118,000 covered lives under small group or large group plans that this bill would affect. That's approximately 17% of the entire population. This bill would not affect basically 83% of the Alaskan population. Let me repeat that. 83% of the people in this state would not be covered by this bill. This is the problem with health care mandates. Only those people that are in small group plans, their pay individual plans, they can't afford to have any other insurance where they pay themselves or they have a small business or that rare larger group plan that's underwritten by the private health insurance industry are mandated by this bill because of ERISA and the fact that self-insured groups are not covered by the health care mandates and regulations of the state of Alaska. So you've got to understand this. It's interesting that Mr. Representative Lynn brings up the point that the witness said that Medicare covers over 65, but then retirees, if you're under 65, which happens to be 75% of all the costs of the our PERS and TERS problem right now, and healthcare drivers, is those people that are under 65 and have retired. That's the kind of stuff that you have to understand that the numbers are and what happens now when we do healthcare mandates. And that's why, as a matter of policy, it's very difficult. We'll have at least one representative from the health insurance business here, but this state is in an incredibly tenuous, fragile situation where we only have basically two primary insurance underwriters here, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which has in excess of 60% of the market, and Aetna that has another smaller share, and then a few other small companies. We have 160 approximately people, and I need to update those stats right now, that actually underwrite the insurance here. And so it's a real problem.
Emily, did you understand that question?
This is the problem here. We're squeezing the people that have to come out of their pocket to pay. All union trust groups and all the unions that have underwritten insurance would even be covered by this bill. So you have to understand that.
Did co-sponsors Crawford, Lynn, Ledoux, Guttenberger, myself understand the question?
If I understand it correctly, like the iron workers insurance already covers it.
Right.
Most of the union trust plans already are there. So, I mean, even though they're not being mandated, they've already done the right thing.
So you mean the 17% is inaccurate? The other, you take 17% from 100, and a lot of that other percentage is already covered.
Mm-hmm.
That's not affected by this law. So when you're a legislator, you're passing a law that affects a limited group of people. That's the point.
You're just bringing
them up. Representative Crawford saying don't be misleading that only 17% then would be covered.
Not misleading. That is the nature of the law. I mean, Mr. Chairman, that's how the impact of the bill is on only this limited, narrow group of people. It has no impact on other groups that may cover that. For example, state of Alaska employees, active employees, are covered and can get colonoscopies. But I've never had a 5-year bariatric enema.
Heath, could you schedule Representative Roper for that?
Dr. Sweeney, are you ready?
Anyway, but that's what you have to keep in mind. That's all.
I'm here.
Yeah. We'll need a garden hose for that one.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Well, at the risk of stepping into a hornet's nest, I mean, would there be any reason why this bill couldn't be expanded to include all of those other entities?
Yeah, they're excluded by ERISA federal law.
That's the answer for that.
Okay, why don't we go next to, because you're talking about some medical aspects. Stephen, we'll get to you. After we get through the off-net here, you're off-net in a sense too, but you're at the Anchorage LIO. Let's go to Bob Sweeney next, then Claudia, Wanda, Stephen, and then we'll wrap it up with Reed, Rick, and Jeff in the committee room here. So,
okay.
Sweeney.
For the record, my name's Brian Sweeney, Jr. I'm a gastroenterologist, board-certified in internal medicine and gastroenterology. I am in private practice in Anchorage after spending 9 years in the Air Force, but bottom line is, I was asked today to by some other people to testify to mainly cover the medical issues related to colorectal cancer screening. I'd be happy to answer questions, but most of the highlights have already been hit by Emily, including the fact that 93% of patients who are diagnosed with stage 1 cancer survive 5 years. Only 8% of those diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, or the most advanced type, survive 5 years. And the other important point that I would like to emphasize is that colorectal cancer screening, through the form of colonoscopy anyway, allows you to take out pre-malignant polyps so that we can catch these before they're even cancers. No other screening test, mandated or not, really gives you the ability to do that. If you do a mammogram, it's already a cancer when you find it. If you do, and that's true for most screening tests, it's not true for colonoscopy. So that 93% number is even higher because you're stopping cancers from occurring. The data does indicate, at least with fecal occult blood testing and flexible sigmoidoscopy, that you do save lives, somewhere around a clip between 20 to 40% for fecal occult blood testing and 60% for flexible sigmoidoscopy. Colonoscopy has not been studied out well enough to know the exact number, but computer models place the number that at 80% reduction in mortality from colon cancer if you were able to screen your population entirely. The problem here is obviously getting people in for screening. Right now, in the United States, about 40% of people roughly get in for colorectal cancer screening. That's up in the last 5 to 10 years from 20% where it was. We're doing better, but it's still not great. The thing that happens to you is you can get into fights with insurance companies that theoretically do cover and say they do cover screening. They may not cover the exact test. And I could sit here and tell you a million stories about the ugly polyp or the ugly cancer I found in the person who was asymptomatic on a screening colonoscopy. I don't really see much point in that. I could tell you a million stories about the person with a family history where the insurance company is fighting you even though they're not average risk because they don't want to cover what they perceive to be a screening procedure. It happens. And the real danger here is that some people make the decision instead of fighting the fight, even if they are higher risk, to decide not to do the procedure. And the problem with that is, as with any other screening program, if they get the cancer, you're going to end up spending a lot of money on them in the long run. Cost-effective analysis actually makes colonoscopy done once every 10 years more cost-effective than mammography, more cost-effective than pap smears, more cost-effective than any other screening test that's ever been well studied. The thing is, it doesn't get the national attention. We don't have all the big names that have gotten colon cancer, and so it gets lost in the shuffle a lot. And that's why you can have the number two cancer killer in this country kind of slip under the radar screen. I'm sure you guys are going to have medical questions, and I've already heard a few questions that I could actually provide answers to, so I'm going to stop there.
Okay, thanks, Dr. Sweeney. Sorry I called you Bob.
That's okay.
We had it written down wrong. We've met. Didn't we meet in Girdwood?
Yes, we did. Yeah,
that's what I thought, Brian. Okay, I'm sorry about that. Listen, the other question is, even though you wouldn't write a fiscal note, you know, we have to have fiscal notes attached to legislation to see where it affects department costs and division costs. Wouldn't you concur that this is an astronomical saving if you multiply this times how many procedures and how many people could get the screening? And as you just noted, these other screenings detect cancer. This screening detects pre-cancer, so you can actually cut off cancer at the pass. Wouldn't you agree that there's a large value added aspect to the bill because of the fact that you're going to cut off this before any future cancer-related procedures come?
I would agree with that, and as a federal taxpayer, a lot of the average age colon cancer gets diagnosed is 67. That colon cancer, if you believe the data that's out there, started as a colon polyp somewhere in that person's 50s. And, of course, by the time they get diagnosed at age 67, they're Medicare's problem. And as a federal taxpayer, I would rather not have that be Medicare's problem. I would rather stomp it out. And I think you can talk about costs all you want, and it is expensive. There's no question about that, but it's no more expensive than any other screening test. And the person who has that colon polyp pulled out with a malignancy in it, and that happened to me just last month. I had somebody asymptomatic, fought with their insurance company. They finally agreed to pay for it. I pulled a polyp out on him that had a small focus cancer in it. If that had been left in there, he would have developed cancer, and who knows? And you know what? For him, it doesn't really we can talk all we want about cost effectiveness and cost per year life saved. None of that would have mattered to him if he'd left it in there.
Well, I hear you. Thanks for the testimony. Are there any questions for Dr. Sweeney? Now's the time for your technical questions. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Sweeney. In the list, if you've seen the page 2 list of minimum coverage requirements for screening practices.
Page 2 on the bill.
Yeah, it has the fecal occult blood test, the sigmoid, then the combinations, colonoscopy every 10 years, double contrast barium enema every 5 years. Is the barium enema, I've been around this a little bit, nobody's ever suggested that. Isn't that for upper GI tract type things, or does that, how do, is that just another tool in your toolbox?
A double contrast air barium enema, they basically put a balloon into your rectum and squirt barium up through your colon and then roll you around on a table to look for colon polyps that way. The American Cancer Society still lists it as a potential screening test. The American College of Gastroenterology actually has looked at all the relevant data on it and has actually eliminated air contrast barium enema from its colorectal cancer screening guidelines. I'm a simple country bumpkin Alaska gastroenterologist, so I don't sit on those committees for the most part, but I think that the American College of Gastroenterology is correct in eliminating it from the colorectal cancer screening guidelines. I really don't think it's a very good test. There actually hasn't ever been a study that shows that you can use air contrast barium enema to effectively screen and save lives. The whole theory behind it has been you're looking at the entire colon, and I will tell you, most of the time, if you do find something on it, you got to get a colonoscopy anyway. So that's what air contrast barium enema is. I think because of the way the bill's written, they're putting the American Cancer Society guidelines on there. That's why that's there.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roper.
That's a follow-up. Thank you, Dr. Sweeney. The witness from the Cancer Society indicated that it was her belief, just in practice, that some of these less intrusive or like sigmoids and the testing measures. I'm aware that many family practitioners and other physicians can administer those tests, but there seemed to be some question about the efficacy of it. So you remember doubling up, or we're because you, as you just mentioned, ultimately if there's any diagnosis or belief that there's further problems, that you're going to go to a colonoscopy rather than use these other tests. So. From a legislative drafting standpoint, it looks as if we'd allow the family practitioner to administer the less intrusive tests, and then like the specialist such as yourself conduct the colonoscopy. What kind of impact cost-wise would that have, or do you think that's the proper methodology?
You know, I give talks on colorectal cancer screening quite a bit, and here's the deal with the test. Fecal occult blood testing has anywhere from about a 3% to a 10% positive rate if you send somebody home with three cards every year. The thing is, you have to do it every year. Getting somebody in to do it every year is difficult. It does have an extremely high false positive rate. The largest study ever done in the United States was done at the Mayo Clinic, and they did demonstrate, you know, close to a 40% reduction in mortality during that study. The thing is, about 40% of the patients in the study got colonoscopies done, and one of the things that's been looked at retrospectively of that study is that really the most of the benefit came from the colonoscopies, not from the fecal occult blood testing. And I will tell you this, getting somebody to come in and do it every year brings up a lot of compliance issues. I am not a big fan of fecal occult blood testing. As far as flexible sigmoidoscopy goes, there's a lot of case series data out there. It does save lives. The combination of the two saves lives. I always look at it this way. If I'm picking up 3 to 10% positive fecal occult blood testings, if I pick up 28 to 25% of patients with a premalignant colon polyp on their flex sig, all those patients I just mentioned are going to have to go on and get a colonoscopy. If you follow the guidelines to a T, which is difficult because people aren't going to come in every year to do their fecal occult blood testing or every 5 years to do their flexible sigmoidoscopy, if you do all that, plus 20% of all patients have a family history of colon cancer and a first-degree relative, if you do all that perfectly, most people are going to go on to colonoscopy anyway. But it goes back to one of the first points I made. Only 40%, even in today's world, are going to get screened for colon cancer. And so the argument I would make to you is you'll hear a lot of people say that doing flexible sigmoidoscopy is like doing mammography on one breast. I actually prefer the other argument, which is if you're a starving man, a half a loaf of bread is better than no loaf at all. So I think if you can get people to do any kind of testing, you're winning.
Oh, and follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Roford.
So it'd be your recommendation that we keep the these basic introductory, if you will, a test that even a general practitioner could administer?
I think that I would keep it in there, and one of the reasons I tell you I would keep it in there is because as much as I do believe that colonoscopy is the best screening test out there, I actually have issues with calling it the gold standard, and that's mainly as an evidence-based physician, I think you need to do the randomized controlled trial to actually prove you save lives instead of using a computer model. I firmly believe if you do that trial, colonoscopy is going to come out that way, but believe it or not, that study has not been done.
And I think, Representative Roper, that's instructive. What you've said, Dr. Sweeney, I think is important and impressive because it indicates that it's not your industry, particularly the gastro experts like yourself, that are pushing this legislation, meaning that it's not a right to work for you type of bill. You're saying, hey, if family practitioners can do the other less intrusive procedures, and even though they may not be as effective, all of it is so critical, and if ultimately it ends up with a colonoscopy, so be it. But isn't that what you're saying, that as long as people are getting the coverage, it doesn't matter if you with your expertise does it or someone else on the smaller tests?
If I might add a couple of points to that, there's actually been some computer models that suggest if you can get people to do fecal occult blood testing every year and do their flexible sigmoidoscopy every 5 years, and again, the problem is it's a lot harder to get people to come back and do that every year, you might actually save more lives than doing colonoscopy every 10 years. There's been at least one computer model study that suggested that. And so I think that from my standpoint, if you could do that, sure. I mean, that's great by me. You're going to save just as many lives doing that. The other thing is colonoscopy, a lot of the stuff about the 80% reduction I talked about in cancer death is based on the National Polyp Study. There have been at least three or four large studies in chemo prevention of colon cancer. Everybody should take their daily aspirin because it prevents colon cancer, by the way. But there's been plenty of studies done recently where we may not be as good at colonoscopy as we thought we were. Because in these recent studies, the miss rates may actually be two or three times higher than they were in the National Polyp Study.
Okay, we just took a poll in the committee room, and unanimously we're all going to give the sample, but we'll pass on the colonoscopy.
Matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I was going to bring that up. It's been my experience that it's harder to self-administer the sample, and you throw it in the ash can because you never get it done right. So I tell you, it's a problem. It's a real problem. I don't think people really follow up with it. Dr. Sweeney, in the bill here, we have the sections of coverage would apply if you're at least 50 years of age and doesn't indicate what gender or anything, or in the alternative, less than 50 years of age and at a higher risk of colorectal cancer. This seems to be relatively open, and I think I understand it. For example, myself, both of my parents in their 80s died of colorectal cancer. So what would my prospectus or prognosis be? Would I be called high risk?
You have two first-degree relatives diagnosed with colon cancer, which defines you as high risk. I think that high-risk patients... In my opinion, there's no excuse for not screening high-risk patients, and I think high-risk patients especially should get colonoscopies done. For yourself, if you have a family history, you're actually more likely to get colon cancers higher up in the colon, so colonoscopy actually is much more important. A couple of other things. If you have a first-degree relative under the age of 60 or two first-degree relatives like you do, you really should start screening at age 40 or 10 years in front of the index case. A lot of that's probably... I don't know if that's sitting in front of you exactly the way I just described it or not. The other issue that comes up is that there are certain people at higher risk. The American College of Gastroenterology, and no one else has done this yet, looked at the data on African Americans, which pale in comparison to the Native Americans we were talking about, and they actually came up with a guideline recently that African Americans actually should begin colorectal cancer screening at age 45, for example.
Thanks, Dr. Sweeney. My staff is sending you Representative Roper's address so you can bill him for that pre-screening. We'll have his records in for the last question, just because Representative Berkowitz.
Right. Dr. Sweeney, you said you were fighting with you had a patient or fighting with an insurance company for coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Would you care to name that company, and how often does that occur in your practice?
You know, I would have to actually look up the chart, and what it doesn't happen a whole lot. I will tell you what happens. Patients are smart, and they figure out that if they have a symptom and they turn this screening colonoscopy into a diagnostic colonoscopy, they're going to get it covered. And a lot of them already come to me, and they've already been coached by somebody to sort of kind of skirt around that. There's a lot of games involved with insurance companies, but I don't remember what insurance company, but I will tell you what happened, basically. I had a patient. We were going back and forth with them, and I ended up finding the malignant colon polyp. He's going to be fine. It's gone. He'll live. But I will tell you this. I've had fights with the Providence Health Care System over screening colonoscopies with their employees. So it happens.
Representative Roper, final comment?
Well, just generally, yeah, I was curious about that. Just I hope the doctor remembers that the patient's bill of rights is out there for your patients. They can always appeal a dispute to a third-party review panel if there is a dispute about coverage, and I know I authored the bill.
Representative, I'd just like you to know I am yet to end up in a situation where the insurance company has not come to the plate and covered the procedure that the person needed to have. It may take a little extra work, but they usually do a pretty good job of doing what they're supposed to do eventually.
Okay, Dr. Sweeney, one last question from Representative Ledoux, then I am going to move on, regardless of questions, because we've done this, but Representative Ledoux hasn't asked any.
On page 3 of the bill, where it talks about individuals considered high risk for colorectal cancer, one of the final thing, number 5, says other predisposing factors. Could you tell me what other predisposing factors there might be besides family history, prior experience, et cetera?
Yeah, Representative, the most common things that put people at high risk for colon cancer are inflammatory bowel disease, and then there's a whole variety of what we call polyposis syndromes, a few syndromes which aren't polyposis syndromes, where basically they have a genetic defect which makes them more likely to develop polyps and colon cancer. I would argue that those patients are not really as much screening patients as surveillance patients. But, for example, I heard the 1 to 2 year thing brought up. That's an inflammatory bowel disease thing. If somebody has ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, after they've had the disease for around 8 to 10 years, they need to get colonoscopies done every 2 years because they are at increased risk to develop colon cancer. I think that I will tell you right now, the high-risk patients that have these disorders, this isn't where the problem is. Those patients, they're so well plugged in with gastroenterologists already, they are going to get their colonoscopies.
Representative Ledoux, follow-up.
I just have a follow-up. Those other predisposing factors that you mentioned, like digestive diseases, inflammatory bowel disease, gene markers, et cetera, those are included in 3 and 4 of the bill. But it says other predisposing factors. And I'm trying to figure out what other predisposing factors might be.
Representative Lynn just made a great comment that ethnicity seems to fall under that category, too. Okay, we'll move on next. Thank you, Dr. Sweeney. You're welcome to stay online, of course, to listen to testimony in case someone else has another question. We'll go next to Claudia Christensen, then Wanda Katinsky can be next. Actually, she's just here for answers with the cancer, so we'll go to Claudia Christensen and then Stephen Warren.
Hi, I'm Claudia Christensen. I am with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in Anchorage, and I have been involved in colorectal screening here for about the past 6 years. Emily and Dr. Sweeney covered a lot of topics. I'm not going to really elaborate on much of what they said, but I can speak from the Alaska Native perspective of us having very high rates of colorectal cancer in Alaska Natives. And Emily had mentioned that it's actually twice any other ethnic group in the world, for reasons that we don't really know. But the problem is that we have always had some of the lowest screening rates in the nation as well, due to lack of providers able to do the tests, distances, remote and rural areas. So several years ago, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and South Central Foundation undertook to begin a screening program here, which actually started with a flexible sigmoidoscopy clinic. And when we looked back at our cases of colorectal cancer over the previous several years, we found that only one case of colorectal cancer was actually found on a screening exam. And the rest of those cases were actually found in advanced stages, which are, of course, not good prognoses. So we began screening, and we actually in the Anchorage Service Unit now have about a 50% screening rate, which is above the national average. That is with colonoscopy and FlexSig. So we're doing okay here, but we're still quite low in a lot of rural areas. Some areas are like single-digit screening rates. So, of course, being a disease that we can actually prevent if caught early, we're attempting to increase those rates. And we actually do have quite high rates of family history, a lot of big families, people who we're attempting to identify to get in for colonoscopy. So that's kind of the background of what we're doing with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. We don't have gastroenterologists in our system. We have general surgeons who do make field visits to try to increase screening rates in rural areas.
That's it. Thank you, Claudia. Any questions for Claudia, Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, do you know if there's ever been any studies done about the nature of the type of insurance for Alaska Natives, and whether or not the Indian Health Service would they not cover 100% of Alaska Natives if they're qualified?
The Indian Health Service does cover colorectal screening for Alaska Natives if they can, if they have access to it, if they live within an area where they can get the screening. I know that Dr. Sweeney does see Alaska Native patients as well who don't come here for care. Not everyone does come through this healthcare system that has the benefits here.
But I imagine there would be some Alaska Natives that have a health insurance company as a primary carrier.
Yes.
But they have a secondary backup, though, would be to the IHS.
IHS, uh-huh.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, no other questions?
Oh, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roper.
One thought. When I talked about the 118,000 lives, there's another 118,000 lives that are covered by stop loss. And the thought occurred to me that depending on what the stop loss was in some of those groups, there may have some coverage that would be covered under a very high deductible plan. So I don't know. Is Dr. Sweeney still online? I could ask him a question.
Dr. Sweeney, are
you? Yes, I'm still here.
Did you hear that? Could you tell a committee approximately what you think the cost of a colonoscopy is in a general range, including physician service as well as the OR totally for a procedure?
In Anchorage?
Yeah, that's good.
Roughly, now keep in mind, depending on what kind of deal or whatever an insurance company works out, billable charges are around $2,500. To give you an idea, the Medicare reimbursement probably runs more about like $700. We all know how Medicare works with things, but that's probably the range you're looking at.
What about the OR costs, though? The other,
I'm including that in that $2,500.
You got a day surgery and get pay the doc for $2,500?
Basically, the facility fee, and I can't.
I don't know.
The facility fee runs about anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000, probably, depending where you're at. The doctor's fee, and I can't, I guess I could go try and pull up, but the doctor's fee probably runs about half of that. But I will tell you that most of the time, if the patient comes through and you pay full price on billable charges, assuming you don't find a polyp, as soon as you find a polyp, the costs go up a little bit. But baseline cost is roughly around $2,500.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Good. We'll go next to, I think, the last person wishing to testify other than anyone in the audience is Stephen Warren in Anchorage with Sitka Community Hospital.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak. First of all, although I work at the community hospital, it's in tobacco cessation, and I'm wearing my private citizen hat right now. My brother Roger was just diagnosed with colorectal cancer, and it is has symptoms, and so he has only about a 10% chance of survival. His insurance did not cover the screening, and I urge you to include this screening in the insurance coverage. I think that it's really cost-effective based on what I've seen that Emily has here, and would really appreciate your passing this. It saves lives and a lot of misery. Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for hanging online so long to testify. There will be some questions for you. Our prayers are with your brother. We hope that works out. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to reiterate that we are very sorry to hear about your family situation with your brother. But you said his insurance company would not cover the screening. Could you tell the committee what insurance company that was or how he was employed?
I don't know his full insurance situation, so I'm sorry I can't share that with you. I simply know when I talked with him that he was not showing symptoms, and so the insurance company did not cover it. I don't know the full details. I'm sorry I can't give you that information.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. What area was he in, the private sector or business world? Or?
He works for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay. We will next go to anyone else offline, or pardon me, offline, off net, that wishes to testify? Hearing none, then we'll go to the committee room. I know Rick Urian's here. He can come up and then read. I hate to put you on the hot seat, but if you want to answer any questions, and then anyone else wishing to testify? No? Okay, we'll go to Rick, then read, then we'll close public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Urian. I normally appear before this committee as a director of a certain division. Today I'm appearing before you as Rick Urian, cancer patient. I never was much for mandates, but it makes a whole lot of sense to me, given my personal experience, that you would spend a few bucks up front to save what the big cost later on if you have full-blown cancer. In my personal experience, I had a colonoscopy, and I had polyps removed. And less than 1 year later, I had a second colonoscopy, and full-blown cancer was found. I had no symptoms at all. I had a tumor that had broken through the wall and immediately had surgery. And I'm before you today, as I hope to say, a cancer survivor because of early detection. And I think it's a wonderful thing that you would include this in insurance policies, and I think it's a good deal.
Boy, thank you, Rick. I know you waited, many of you did, on Friday and then today, so I appreciate you, your patience with hearing the bill and your support. Are there any questions for Mr. Urian? Thank you. Thanks for coming. Reed, we'll have you.
He's an E-poor, so we know he had state coverage. Okay. Oh, sorry about that. That's a state joke.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Reed Stoops, and I'm here today on behalf of the American Health Insurance Association. I guess first I'd like to speak just generally to the issue of mandates and then specifically to the bill. As Representative Roekberg alluded to at the beginning of the hearing, the general problem with mandates is that over the years, I think there's probably been a dozen or more mandated coverages adopted by the legislature, and individually a lot of those had pretty marginal cost implications. But taken together, the cost is more significant. And where they're applied is they're applied to small group and individual coverage, which are the people that have the hardest time affording insurance. So the policy trade-off you're making is, on the one hand, you're providing, you know, what may be better coverage, but at an expense that also makes insurance more less affordable for the people who have the hardest time affording it. So that's sort of just in a nutshell what the policy issue. The association generally recommends mandated offerings as opposed to coverage, so that anybody has the option to buy the coverage if they wish, but it doesn't necessarily have to be included in every policy. In this particular case, given the fact that the majority of the committee looks like they're going to be co-sponsors of the bill, we'd like to offer some alternatives, since colorectal screening is generally covered by most of the plans that I'm aware of anyway. And the one recommendation to improve the legislation would be to adopt some language which I provided to the committee staff last week, which comes, I think, from the Tennessee law that references, instead of subsection B, which provides the specific screening exams, reference the current American Cancer Society guidelines or the U.S. Preventative Service Task Force guidelines for colorectal cancer screening, so that whatever those guidelines are at any given time would be what would have to be offered in the way of insurance coverage, as opposed to trying to put some static screening tests into the statute, which would have to be amended every time the science changes, and you have to, let's say that some of the tests are determined not to be particularly effective, or you have new tests that are discovered in the future that become the standard, rather than having to come back and change the law.
And I'm going to interject here, because this is a critical time. Members of the committee have had passed out, you say Tennessee? What was the state?
I think, I'm not sure. I think it was, yes, the Tennessee law.
And it was another state's reference. I won't reference the number because I don't want to confuse the committee secretary in terms of putting that in. But it's an extract from their statute. And if the members of the committee can follow me, and if folks out in the audience are looking, it's the first paragraph's final sentence, partial sentence, underline. And I'll read it in the record. It's coverage for colorectal cancer examinations and laboratory tests specified in current American Cancer Society guidelines or United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines for colorectal cancer screening of asymptomatic individuals, period. And what I believe Mr. Stoops is getting at is, and I concur, that we'd like to take that underlined from the first paragraph language and delete, if you go to the bill on page 2, lines 5 through 14, which are basically a definition of all the six minimum covered screening tests that we were just talking about. So we would extract and delete lines 3 through 14 and add this reference. The colorectal cancer examinations are covered by American Cancer Society guidelines or United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines. And we think this is more encompassing, and as the sponsor, I concur. And if you understand, then we'll get to more questions, and then I'm going to make that amendment. Representative Ledoux.
I just want to make sure that it's only the stuff underlined as
correct.
Opposed to
it is.
All
that's
of A.
That's why I read it verbatim. Right.
What about B? Or is that
no,
separate?
No, that's why I just specifically said it's the first
B was
paragraph.
The
B is underlined too, though.
Oh,
so.
Okay. But Mr. just the first paragraph, because I don't want to get that second section I don't know if I agree with, but...
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Ledoux's question, B is something we're interested in, but upon review of the bill, we came to the conclusion that that's already covered. Let me see which section it is.
Starting on page 1, line 14.
Okay,
and that's the end of the end of page 1, beginning of page 2. I think it does make clear that you're not doing anything to affect the normal deductible or copay provisions that would normally be found
and
in
for
policies.
The record, if someone were listening to this, looking at a transcript, again, what we're going to add, and I will just make that, and I think the Cancer Society, they're not opposed to this either, and I'm getting a head shake from the audience from Mr. Hickey, then I will make amendment number 1, which deletes on page 2 of House Bill 393 lines... What would it be, 3? Or lines 5 to lines 14. And it would insert, as Representative Ledoux noticed, quote, coverage for colorectal cancer examinations and laboratory tests specified in current American Cancer Society guidelines or United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines for colorectal cancer screening of asymptomatic individuals, period. And the cancer affiliates, associations, and insurance industry, in this case, the American Health Insurance Association, and me as the sponsor, supports the amendment. Are there
objection? For,
okay,
discussion
for discussion
only.
Purposes, Representative Lynn, then real quick.
So am I to understand, then, that the proposed amendment covers everything at the moment they have between 1 and 6, between lines 5 and 14? It might change in the future if new techniques are discovered, but at the moment, it covers these different things here.
And Representative Lynn, exactly. It covers those six, and it leaves it open so
for
that
future.
As new, exactly, where we'd have to go and amend later.
Yeah,
Representative
Roper.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't take as a friendly amendment the words as an optional benefit in front of that?
No, I wouldn't.
And it made a mandated offering so you can underwrite for it?
I prefer it the way it is so that it's mandated.
So you wouldn't look at it as a friendly amendment. Then I won't offer it.
Okay. Thank you. You can try. Okay, so that's amendment number 1 before us. Do I have any objection? Hearing none, so moved. And the second part of this document that we have from another state's statutes, as noted, I won't even get into that description on record, but it was an appropriate question from Representative Ledoux for clarification. Any other questions for Mr. Stoops? Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, are you here representing also Aetna?
Aetna is a member of the association, and Aetna, I guess, is not quite as concerned because they're in the large group market and traditionally cover colorectal screening, including the state of Alaska plan. So it's not going to be a big change for the Aetna policies, but the other members of the association are generally the carriers who represent the small group and individual market in Alaska, and those are the carriers, as I indicated, that this would have a greater effect on.
Representative Ledoux?
Could you tell the committee what market share Aetna has for private group underwriting in the state for actual insurance?
It's TPA. Varied over time. I would probably assume about a third of the market.
About 30%.
30 to 40%, depending on the time.
About 60%.
The two together, I would say, I would just guesstimate 80%, 85% of the market. There's probably about 15% of the market, though, that are divided up among the, probably 50 or more other carriers.
And so, Mr. Chairman, your testimony is that you don't really cover the individual and small group plans, though.
Aetna is generally in the larger group, the self-insured market, so they're not as affected as the members of the association who offer, or they're primarily in the small group and to some extent the individual market. And Blue Cross is actually the company that's, they cover a lot of the individual market, so you might check with them.
Good. Okay, Representative Ledoux.
I just wanted to know if you have any opinion as to if this bill is passed, what that's going to cost with respect to individual policies. What's that going to cost per person?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, by the time this comes back up to hearing again, I'll try to get some cost information. There was cost information about the cost of the procedure today. But what I don't know today is how many of the plans don't offer the half a dozen tests or so that would currently be covered by the bill. So I'll see if I can get some indication of how many of those tests aren't covered by what percentage of the plans and try to get you at least a rough estimate, but I can't answer that today.
Thank you. Sure.
We'll supplement that by Hess when it goes to the Hess committee next week.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, no more committee testimony.
I would
questions, Representative Lynn?
Move the bill at this point. Mr. Chairman,
the Division of Insurance is not going to testify.
Oh,
Jeffrey Chodd, Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance. I don't have any prepared testimony. I came in case.
That's right. That's why I didn't call Jeffrey. Do you have a question for the representative?
No, I would. Yeah, I would have a question for him.
Okay. Sorry, Jeffrey.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to explain to the committee for the record what, to either verify or question any of the testimony I made about the impacts of this insurance mandate on the insurance market in the state. And what their professional opinions are about insurance mandates, so there's an understanding on the record of where the committee is going.
Let's start for the record. My name is Jeffrey Trout. I'm the deputy director for the Division of Insurance for the state of Alaska. Our position on mandates probably won't make anybody happy. We don't support mandates, but we generally don't actively oppose them either. I can't tell you how much money this is going to cost, but this is obviously going to cost some money. At $2,500 a pop, it will probably be expensive. But nevertheless, it's a legislative determination, and while we don't support them, we don't actively oppose them.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, do you have any idea on the stop-loss carriers? Typically, how much is there an average or deductible, or do you have any handle on that at all?
On stop-loss carriers for an average deductible, I don't know. To the chair.
And the reason is that there are another 17% that are stop-loss people out there that may be impacted by this legislation if, in fact, this one procedure is so high they run into their deductible and then it would start paying. So my 17% rough estimate would be incorrect then if they got into their higher deductible. But that just depends on what it is. Typically, there are higher, maybe $5,000 or $10,000. It just depends on the plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, since he doesn't know the answer to that, he can supplement before it comes before the Hess committee, as will Mr. Stoops, who's just departed, will supplement Representative Ledoux's question and Representative Roper.
I'll be happy to do that.
It would be very helpful if we had some information from Blue Cross Blue Shield as a primary impacted carrier here.
We'll contact them.
Mr. Trout, you tell us how many insurance companies are authorized to do business here and what the market share is for the top three or four?
I believe I concur with what the Through the chair, Representative Robert Rockford, I believe that I concur with the testimony we've heard before that Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield hold the lion's share. And there are, I believe there's 100 or more licensed insurance carriers in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Or health insurance, I should say.
Okay, then I'll close public testimony, seeing no other individuals wishing to testify or hearing them online. We'll go back to Representative Lynn, who is about to make a motion to move the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move HB 393-24-LS0780/G as amended with individual recommendation and attached indeterminate fiscal notes.
Awesome.
I'll object.
Okay, Representative Roper will object for...
I just want to say that I'm very concerned about... this has affected my family. It's affected my personal life. I've had a colonoscopy. It's important that we all do that, participate in that, and then get the word out. It's very important. But I would just ask and caution this committee, as a matter of policy, this committee has been the leader in this building in trying to maintain a market that would invite insurance companies to come into this state to write health insurance policies. That's the main thing. We have an 800-pound gorilla in the form of Blue Cross. We have Aetna that's writing larger policies. Basically, we have one insurance company up here. We need more. I'm trying to get the Department of Health and Social Services to actually invite an HMO to come to Alaska just so we can have a choice. We have no choice here. So think about what you're doing here. You're putting up another barrier for entry into this marketplace. And we're starting to develop a reputation in Alaska of being open to that and not have a large number of mandates. And that's an important thing. I mean, but in the 12 years I've been on this committee, I can't say that we've gotten a new insurance company to come here and take a big market share either. That's been the goal, but we haven't run anybody out, so I'm not sure where we're at in that regard. But I think it's a huge public policy issue here that you're taking on, and there's major ramifications of it, particularly when the small business people are paying this. And I got to tell you, both of my parents were covered by the IBEW plan. They would not be affected by this bill. That's what people have to understand. Most of the people in this state are covered under self-insurance plans or other plans with stop-loss or non-stop-loss, Indian Health Service, and various other methods. A very small percentage of the people, 20% of Alaskans are now on Medicaid, 20%. 50% of all the children born in the state are covered by Medicaid. I mean, this is the direction of the health care in the state, so be very careful when you're doing this. With that, Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my objection.
Thank you. And just for the record, as the sponsor of the legislation and having been a facilitator of many insurance bills and legislation in the spirit of what you, your foundation of your speech, I would also comment that I also carried, and another representative's bill passed ultimately, but carried the bill on tort reform and on curbing medical malpractice, and I have yet to see any of the medical malpractice providers, as I talk to folks, and I'm sure Dr. Sweeney shaking his head, reduce their rates. Now, that wasn't one of the main reasons for which we pushed the tort reform, but it was certainly one of 10 that we say, hey, we hope the climate reduces to bring in more insurers, and that didn't happen. So, not to get in a debate, but I would say that we'll find out on the other 18 states, in the other 18 states, how many carriers left, or if that changed the environment in the HES committee, we can supplement that statistic. Because I would be interested to see if we did this bill passes, to see insurance carriers say, because of that bill by Anderson, because of that mandatory colorectal screening, we're not going to come to Alaska. That's a good question, public policy question. I don't know if you're right on the answer. Not sure. Any other comments? No objection? Bill passes. And it goes on to the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee for further review. And we go next to, and we'll, they've been very patient. We had them first and didn't have someone here. Someone is here now. House Bill 335, she's been patiently waiting. Representative Berkowitz's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
My name's Lisa Weisler, staff to Representative Berkowitz, who appreciates the hearing on this bill. I think as most people are aware, Alaska communities are currently paying ever-increasing costs for fuel, and there need to be long-term solutions that are going to make the communities more self-reliant and less vulnerable to these volatile fossil fuel prices. So House Bill 335 has three main provisions. The first one is that the Alaska Energy Authority will conduct the initial assessments to determine the viability of alternative energy sources statewide, report its findings, and then assist communities to determine what the right energy source is for their area. And then for wind power, the state will conduct any necessary assessments. Now, the reason for this is to take advantage of the cost efficiencies we can get through a coordinated assessment. It's also because many communities cannot afford sort of the upfront cost to determine, one, what the best energy source is, and also, in the case of wind power, to determine whether or not it's actually going to work for their area. The next provision, main provision, is providing a way to pay for any alternative energy that the communities might decide works for them. And this is a low-interest loan fund, 2% interest, and a way to pay it down is through production incentive credits. These are credits that are generated by the production from alternative energy facilities, and this gives the incentive to have a good working facility, keep it up to speed, and that then reduces the cost of the communities. Then the third provision is providing for a partnership between the state and energy-related interests. This is through a committee that's going to develop and guide implementation of the energy program. This brings the right people to the table. It's not just the state dictating what should be done. It gets the folks that know the utilities, know the energy issues in the state, brings them together, and actually gives them a strong say in the development of this program. So the bill is going to apply to alternative energy sources, and once these facilities are built, we're hoping will provide stable energy prices for all of Alaska communities. There should be a committee substitute in your packet. This is based on a conversation we've had with utilities, and the changes in there are from those conversations. The biggest changes are, one, is giving this committee that the bill proposes is the duty to develop the regulations. Again, this is so that the right people are developing and guiding this program. It also is deleting the requirement to create energy portfolio standards and a tradable credit system. This was an idea where utilities would have to produce a certain amount of energy from alternative energy sources. If they're unable to do so, that they would be able to buy credits from an area that is producing the energy. Right now, that it's a question whether that would really work in Alaska. Utilities weren't very excited about it. Wasn't a big thing, so we're taking that out. So that's the main parts of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Then I will move that we adopt CS for House Bill 335, version I, for discussion purposes, and have before the committee, hearing and seeing no objection, version I of House Bill 335, as noted with changes, is before us. We can either go to questions for the sponsor's legislative aid, or we can go to individuals wishing to testify. And I think Becky Gay is online, and she might be a good person to testify. And then questions for her. Do you want to hold them for Becky with the Alaska Energy Authority?
Well, who?
Representative Lynn.
Well, let me ask a question here. Would there be any statutory conflict between Alaska Energy Authority and this proposed new committee?
There was a question raised on that by legal services, but they did not say that there was. They just said it might be an issue, and they did not explain whether it really is or not. So it's in there for now, and we'll explore that further.
And is that something maybe you could have documented through correspondence from legislative
services? I have the memo from them, yes.
It goes to the committee, after we hear this, it goes to House Finance, so maybe by that.
Right, so I'll have it a little more clarification.
One more quick one.
Representative Lynn.
As I understand it, the Alaska Energy Authority currently manages some 47 projects with state federal funds, I guess about $22 million for hydroelectric, wind, geothermal, et cetera. Would this bill end up creating any kind of conflicts or redundancies with the authority, do you think?
Actually, the idea with this bill is to coordinate, to bring all of that together. Because right now a lot of it is quite piecemeal.
And that's a good question for Becky Gay with the Alaska Energy Authority. Seeing no other questions for Representative Berkowitz's office, then we will go next to Becky Gay off net, and then Mira Kohler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Becky Gay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I also have Peter Krimp, our project manager for the alternative energy section here at AEA, standing by for questions as well.
Great.
I have some brief comments prepared, if I could go ahead with that.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Becky Gay, project manager for the Alaska Energy Authority, AEA. My comments today are brief and will just speak to the aspects of the proposed legislation which affects AEA. And we want to appreciate your interest in the Alaska Energy Authority and thank the sponsors of the bill for their particular interest in alternative energy as demonstrated by this proposal. AEA's concerns regarding HB 335 as proposed relate primarily to two things, the duplication of efforts and statutory powers, and its potential for conflicts of interest, particularly between AEA's board of directors and this new entity created by the legislation called the Committee on Alaska Energy Research and Development. AEA's statutory powers include equipping and improving power projects, waste energy, energy conservation, and alternative energy facilities and equipment, and loans for them. To support these efforts, AEA projects and programs already provide for assisting in the development of safe, reliable, and efficient energy systems throughout Alaska, which are sustainable and environmentally sound. They provide for reducing the cost of electricity for residential customers and community facilities in rural Alaska, and it provides for our ability to respond quickly and effectively to electrical emergencies. With our professional engineering staff and accounting staff and their combined years of physical plant expertise, AEA really focuses on implementing commercially proven technology for secure and reliable forms of energy in Alaska, including alternatives to diesel. For research and development aspects of the diverse areas such as fuel cells, energy storage, diesel efficiency, and the rural energy conference, AEA currently cooperates and partners with the federally funded Arctic Energy Technology and Development Laboratory based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. As I noted in the beginning of these comments, there are also potentials for conflicts with this proposed committee. First of all, the members proposed in the committee would have an inherent conflict of interest since the utilities and the energy providers described are likely to come from the same small pool of past and potential future AEA grantees. And moreover, the powers of AEA are vested in its board of directors. HB 335 provides that AEA shall administer the new programs, but that the Committee on Alaska Energy and Research Development shall provide oversight on the program. This usurps statutory powers and the responsibilities of the board, and it actually sets up potential management conflicts. They have very broad powers, as you'll see. Providing that the committee shall adopt regulations and that the AEA shall, providing that the committee shall develop regulations and that AEA shall adopt them may also violate due process protections if AEA is somehow constrained from following the Administrative Procedures Act. In conclusion, we appreciate your interest, but we also want you to please recognize that AEA has a wide variety of ongoing energy initiatives, some of which are addressed in this legislation, including specifically alternative energy source development and applications, alternative energy resource assessment and data dissemination, community and/or regional meetings on alternative energy options, wind energy assessment program, monitoring feasibility analysis and design, and energy loan funds. Notably, AEA is also an owner of large alternative energy assets for the state, namely Bradley Hydro near Homer and Larsen Bay Hydro in Kodiak Island. In conclusion, it might be noted that the non-commercial research efforts, such as envisioned in this legislation, might be better cultivated in an academic setting, like the university, which we work with directly. And that could enhance both our combined efforts and maybe lead to new technology applications for Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and that's, I'm done and ready for questions.
Thanks, Becky. This is Chairman Anderson. We're going to get to questions from the committee, but my suspicion is that, or speculation is that the folks, Representative Berkowitz and his staff can comment as well, and the co-sponsors are not looking as this committee should be a replacement to the Alaska Energy Authority, but rather motivating it, channeling it to these areas like wind generation, my guess is solar, all the alternative energy methods that are out there. And what is your response with regard to the bill in terms of, you mentioned like maybe having it be a derivative of the university, or you were in fear of the duplication of efforts and potential conflicts of interest, and then later you brought up the due process problems. So you object to the bill in its entirety, or do you think that there's a way we can negotiate as we analyze the bill and maybe have this Committee on Alaska Energy Research and Development, or a different name, but some type of entity within Alaska Energy Authority? What is your thought? Like, no way to this, and you don't want any extra committees to, you, as you, quote, said, usurping your power? Or do you think you could work with the bill sponsor and co-sponsors and our committee to try to structure this so it works in your paradigm?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. We actually are looking at the proposal, and we had our AGs look at it in regard to what was duplicative or over or usurped or, you know, conflicted directly. And we all felt that the committee was way too broadly powered with regard to what control it had over what AEA already does in its programmatic efforts. And there's no, you know, sense of a large funding effort going along with this that's going to help us do these things. So it's more like diluting what we already do, although we believe this bill is sort of an endorsement of what we already do in some regards.
Okay. Representative Lynn, then Representative Roepberg.
You indicated this could be done in an academic setting. What about private enterprise doing that? I have notes here that in Skagway, the local power company generates much of its energy through hydroelectric power, and your AEA works with private companies like this all over the state. What about just private industry filling in this gap?
Through the chair, I'd like Peter Krimp, our alternative energy manager, to answer that if I could.
Peter, if you could state your name and affiliation or title within the authority for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter Krimp, Alaska Energy Authority Project Manager for Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency. In response to that last question, I think that the quick answer is it takes all sorts of assistance. There are some questions that are best, or some projects that are best addressed by commercialized technology and power utilities directly. Hydroelectric is a mature technology that works. It needs to be applied in as many places as we can economically and technically apply it. There are other technologies such as fuel cells, microturbines, in some cases, biodiesel, that require assistance from a university, and where there's more research and development that needs to take place. The Arctic Energy Technology Development Lab's in good shape to do that, as is Alaska Power and Telephone to develop the Skagway Hydro.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I may have another question later on.
No problem. Representative Roepberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Krimp, is the Arctic Energy Development Laboratory, is that through UAF, or what is your relationship with UAF right now on these issues?
Yeah, thanks. Arctic Energy Technology Development Laboratory is a UAF laboratory in the School of Engineering that is funded by the U.S. Department of Energy's Arctic Energy Office in Fairbanks. And our affiliation is to help choose projects. We sit on a board, as do Alaska Village Electric Co-op and others, interested parties, for helping choose remote energy projects.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roper.
include wind energy and siting and those particular issues?
A major problem with the Arctic Energy Technology Lab now is that all of the funding it gets is from the fossil energy side of the U.S. Department of Energy. There's a general consensus that it would be better served if USDOE's energy efficiency and renewable energy funds could also be brought to bear, and that would give it much wider applicability in places where hydro, wind, and other renewables are being considered.
Well, do we need to talk to our congressional delegation about that, or what?
My boss has written a letter to that effect.
Send me a copy.
Okay.
Hey, good. Now, Representative Lynn had a question for the sponsor's representative, which I think is appropriate on record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this HB 335, is this a program that works pretty much like the one the state used to have through the now-defunct Alaska Science and Technology Foundation? As I understand, the legislature abolished that, and that one offered financing for these projects, alternative energy at a local individual level. And I guess, why are we reviving something that the state no longer saw fit to fund? Is there a reason?
To be quite honest, I was not aware of that. The sponsor was not aware of that program. This was really kind of started from scratch and looking at what is going on now and trying to find a way to jumpstart alternative energy development in the state, because we seem to have reached sort of a crucial time right now where energy costs are going up, the technology is coming up, you know, it's improving, and it just seemed like the right time to sort of bring all those pieces together.
If I may, I do in fact support alternative energy. Even the President and the State of the Union addressed this subject, but if you could maybe at some point get an answer to the question we had, that would be appreciated.
And Representative Berkowitz can probably answer that. 3 years ago, actually our first year, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Lynn, and myself, one of the big issues was the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation and funding of that or not, and it ended up that the legislature, not unanimously, of course, decided to delete that from the budget and removed it. So there is no longer that fund or process, and you understand Representative Lynn's question was basically, are we bringing that back? Because a lot of this is pattern after that.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Was that, did they have other things that they did as well, or was it strictly alternative energy?
No. Lots it was of things. All sorts.
Okay.
It wasn't okay. Even related directly to alternative, but it's
okay.
Some aspects of this.
Thank you.
I didn't like getting rid of it, to be honest. Any other questions?
Well, the widget tinkering?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a good program, I thought.
Oh, I have a question.
Representative Roper.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at the community substitute. It looks like they deleted carbon credits. Is that entirely out of the CS or what? Or just part? No, it's not.
No.
It's still in there?
Yes, through the chair, it is still in there. It's one of these things where we were looking for alternative sources of funding, and there is a growing belief that there will be a carbon cap eventually nationally, and that the state may be able to take advantage of that through sequestration. You all remember carbon sequestration.
I was going to ask, wasn't the resolution we passed in the, isn't the Department of Economic
Resources.
Development, or is it Natural Resources?
Natural Resources.
Were they looking into it? What's come of that or anything?
They, through the chair, Representative Roper, they looked into it a bit, but really have not done a whole lot. They are still interested, but they lack the funds to do it. We did encourage them to seek grants. We gave them places to look for grants, but because of the fire seasons and a variety of other things, I don't believe much has happened there, but you should ask them.
Maybe a cap, because I understand like all the signatories to the Kyoto Treaty are not meeting their caps, but the U.S. is the only country, industrial country, that's brought their growth rate below the carbon production caps, and they were in a signature. How about that?
Yeah, no, that's good. Welcome to Labor and Commerce Committee, where we don't ask questions. We all of us have our signal. But we love Representative Roper. Okay, next individual that wants to actually testify is the last person that wants to testify, unless someone from the audience stands, and that's Mira Kohler from the Alaska Village Electric
Cooperative.
That's what I thought. Good. I thought you were the same. Hi, Mira.
Hi, Tom.
All right, I guess I'm on. This is Mira Kohler. I am the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, and I appreciate the opportunity given to me today to testify in support of House Bill 335. As was noted by Lisa Weisler earlier, several of us have worked together with Representative Berkowitz to help him to develop and refine the bill that he has before you at this particular point in time, and we believe that the way it is currently presented is appropriate. I certainly understand that the Alaska Energy Authority has concerns about a potential conflict between the committee and their board, but I would respectfully put forth to you that the AEA board is the same as the ADA board, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, and that basically consists of six individuals, three of whom are commissioners and one of whom is a deputy commissioner, and there are two public members. I don't believe that that board would represent quite the interest that's necessary to develop the regulations that could potentially have a great deal of impact well into the future on Alaska's most outlying communities. I think many of you are probably aware that Alaska Village Electric Co-op is a co-op that serves about 44% of Alaska's village population in 52 villages throughout Alaska. We have begun in the last few years a very tentative effort to try and bring alternative energy into our communities. It is an extremely expensive and laborious process, but nonetheless we believe it is what needs to be done because it does displace diesel fuel into the future. We believe that it's important for that effort to continue, and this bill will provide the wherewithal for a lot of that to continue. The bill is actually a pretty modest effort to try and help offset some of the very high costs of alternative energy development. Typically, you'll find that wind energy, for example, is going to cost in the region of $5,000 to $6,000 a kilowatt, which is about 5 to 6 times what diesel generation costs. So a 2% loan program basically means that you're going to be able to offset part of the principal an interest and reduce a potentially $30,000 a year cost on a $300,000 project or a $500,000 project down to about $25,000 a year. So it's a modest inroad, but it's nonetheless a very valuable incentive to bring up projects that might otherwise not occur. I know the hour is getting late, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time, and I'd be delighted to answer questions.
Thank you, Mira. Any questions, Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you.
And then real quick.
So it's your from your statement, you believe enough hasn't been done in alternative energy?
A lot remains to be done. The Energy Authority is making very good progress in assessing the wind regimes that might yield alternative energy projects in rural Alaska. That needs to be done over more of the state, and this will encourage that to occur. In terms of actual development of alternative energy, that is typically going to happen only by the utilities that are serving these communities, and it is going to be a laborious process, but it needs to start. Not much is happening right now simply because there isn't much that's commercially viable that's available, but it is starting to catch on now, and I think that we can make progress.
Representative Rookberg.
Yeah, to the chair. Ms. Kohler, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you? I was sorry to hear about your rather unfortunate family experience with colorectal cancer, and I can tell you that I'm making plans to see Mr. Sweeney myself in the near future.
Very good. I highly recommend it.
Take a number.
My question is this. I think I'm the governor's. What would you rather, in your position, what would you rather have the legislature do? Appropriate monies to the emergency fuel and rural fuel program or to an energy loan fund?
Well, in the best of all worlds, I'll take them both.
Well, I don't think our surplus is in existence anymore. So
it's quite that large.
Governor's got $300 million in supplemental appropriations on the table, so we're kind of toast on that. Anyway, nice to hear from you.
Okay, Mira, this is Chairman Anderson. I'm in one of those tenuous positions because I respect Becky Gay's opinion and certainly Mr. Crimp's thoughts with regard to Alaska Energy Authority. on the surface, kind of on the periphery, they make some points that you would expect them to make. Hey, wait a minute, you're duplicating what we're doing. Or, hey, wait, there could be a conflict because there's a kind of a committee within a committee. Or, wait, what if this CAERD is too overpowered and, like Becky states, dilutes AEA's power? Conversely, not only with your testimony, but, I mean, we have some committee members that are co-sponsors. I always take that to heart. When I decide whether to move a bill out on the first committee after the first committee hearing. But if you look at the bill, it is instructive for things that I think all the committee members have noted they support. Alternative energy, assessments, surveys, reports on this, how it's viable for the state, a little bit more emphasis than probably AEA has given in terms of community meetings, site monitoring and visiting, an actual energy loan fund. That's established to induce people to potentially come to Alaska, incentives for credits and debt reduction, direction for grants. The committee itself pretty broad in terms of its membership and those backgrounds. And then, of course, a power and duties section. I could put this in a subcommittee, and then we could break this down. And what tends to happen is then everyone gets their 2 cents in, and it delays. The next committee of referral is the House Finance Committee. In terms of our purview, which always can be beyond labor and commerce but should be centered on labor and commerce, I think we've addressed at least partially where this is affected. Do you see any things that stick out that, in your opinion, with your knowledge of it, how AEA operates, that completely, I don't know, I guess usurps the power from AEA, where if the bill was passed, it would adversely affect AEA's ability?
Well, obviously, in my opinion, I don't think so. I think that there could be a very harmonious relationship over here, because I think that the ADA AEA board has much bigger fish that it fries at this particular point in time. It manages the entire investment portfolio of the ADA group, and AEA has actually a very modest portfolio of alternative energy projects. They mentioned Bradley Lake and Larsen Bay. Bradley Lake, as you are well aware, is the hydro project that was built for the rail belt back in 1986. And Larsen Bay is a very small hydro project on Kodiak Island that also was built some 10 or 12 years ago, maybe longer. They are not really in the business of developing and installing alternative energy in rural Alaska, nor should they be, I don't think. I think that's something that the utilities should be taking care of, and with encouragement through a bill like this, that could occur. So I really don't see a major source of conflict.
Okay. I know we have Chris and Bob not interested necessarily in testifying from the Division of Forestry and Division of Geologic something, so I'm not going to go to them in terms of testimony because I don't think they want to at this stage. I would advise AEA to submit a more detailed and, I guess, assiduous analysis of the bill, in this case what we have before us, the new version, version I, CS for HB 335. I don't see the harm in moving it on to the Finance Committee. There'll still be a scheduling process, and there'll be time for them and any other interested parties. They'll have to gather up folks who may feel that they're adversely affected by the legislation. I don't see complete detriment based on what they said, and I think there's a lot of value in what the bill is changing statutorily. So I'll entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee. And you can put individual reckon, and it'll move on and be scheduled for House Finance, unless you have some members of the Labor and Commerce Committee has some idea on the powers and duties of the committee, or you want to change something specifically in the bill that you've caught. Representative Roper.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was taken with the testimony of Ms. Gay about the duplicative and dilutive aspects of this bill. It seems to me that the AEA has already been established. It has one nice thing about it. It has an income stream, and this bill requires an appropriation from the legislature. Plus, it's got $500,000 worth of fiscal notes alone from ADA. But the source of funding here to create this, the engine, retakes a standalone, separate appropriations bill. So it's a toothless tiger without money. And frankly, I think the sponsor would be better off if he looked at trying to marry the existing AEA with what his objects are and pick up from that and use the university, which is, these are already programs in existence. So we're too small a state. We can't run around having multiple different programs and try to finance them all where they become competitive with each other. That's what really scary, bureaucrats competing with each other for more money from the general fund. You know, that gets to be a bad thing. So I'm not real comfortable with this particular legislation as it is now.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I signed on as a co-sponsor of this legislation because I didn't feel that that the focus here has been on alternative energy sources, especially for the rural areas where we have such a problem with the high cost of diesel generation. We wanted to move that focus towards renewables, and you know that we never ever wanted this to be something in competition with what is there now. We wanted to have this in addition to, so that we could actually bring a focus to renewables. We feel that for years now there's been no focus on renewables. So what the sponsor's representative said here is that this is a bill to jumpstart that focus. So we're getting close to the end of our term here, and I think that time is of the essence, and I believe that we'd be well served and the state would be well served to go ahead and move this on to the next committee of referral and answer those questions at the finance committee level.
And do you concur that the finance committee is already 2 weeks out in calendaring? So that's my rationale. But we can hold it here for a week or two or three, and Representative Roepberg can be the facilitator in a subcommittee for AEA to, which they haven't given written, they've given substantive oral testimony over the line, but it would be nice to have some written testimony and some analysis of where there's duplicity in some of those other aspects. But in the meantime, as we have precedent for many bills, I think I've heard everybody's bill at some point or another over the last 3 years, 1 year for some of you, where we've moved it on to keep it flowing. So that would be my 2 cents. Any other committee comments? So do you want to make the motion then?
Mr. Chairman, before we do that, is Ms. Kohler still online? Mira, are you still there?
She's got better things to do.
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh! Hi, Mira. It's Pete Cotty here. I'm always looking for alternatives to carpeting.
Sounds like a winner to me.
Are you aware of any nuclear projects that may be springing up in the state?
I am aware of one that is attempting to go through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to get a permit, and that's a 10-megawatt project that is proposed for Galena. And that one, I'm not sure how far away it is from actually being permitted, but the costs for the project are currently being carried by its primary sponsors, which is Toshiba. And I'm not sure who the U.S. sponsor is. It may be General Electric or another firm like that. If they are successful in getting that permit, the actual project is probably still several years down the road. And I don't think that this bill actually includes nuclear energy as alternative energy at this point in time. But that's the only project that I know of.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, seeing no other questions from the committee, public testimony then has been closed, and I'll entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee. Representative Crawford.
Any further discussion? Okay.
Yep.
Well, I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 335, version I, with individual recommendations and attached physical notes.
Okay, there's an objection from Representative Roepberg. If the secretary wants to just go in order of Representative Crawford, you don't have to get up and just call our names out.
It's Crawford.
Oh, that's
yes, you go.
Oh,
That's okay. You're looking at a paper list.
Yes.
That's okay. So, yes?
Yes.
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 No.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the bill moves out of committee 6-1, and Representative Mulder, who's in the audience, says he would have voted for it, but he's gone.
Well, that just sounds like
he actually didn't say that, Becky.
6-1.
Okay, that bill moves out of committee, and we will now adjourn the Labor and Commerce Committee at 5:12.